body, live in a normal heights area. I would have to say one of the first times I was actually discriminated against, I would have to say it was actually joining this group. It was more so less of people just, oh, well, you know, they like to whip people, they like to spit on people, they like to, I was like, well, it's, you know, first acronym of the word, fetish. It's your fetish. Many different fetishes. So I guess I can say I love Men in Black and No, not the movie.
Magnum, I'm originally from Detroit, born and raised in Detroit, and the first time that, there's a lot of incidents, I mean, I could just go on, but I think the first significant time of me being a black person, being a black man, my mother and I, we went shopping in Dearborn, and Dearborn at the time used to be a very white neighborhood, and it was very, it was like, you could feel the wall. And my mother took me, we went shopping over at Montgomery Ward's. And I remember walking through the store, I was probably about 10 or 12 years old. And we were going through the store, and my mother was looking for to buy a washing machine. And I remember that the people in the store just kept following my mother around and following us around the store and asking us, can we help you? And my mother said she was just looking, and I remember and it was a white woman, and she said to my mother that, I can't exactly remember exactly what she said, but it was confrontational. I remember my mother she got very upset, she grabbed me, and we walked to the car, going to the car, and she said, I'll never come out here again and shop again. And I could just feel that discriminated against just on the color of my skin. And I even feel it today. You know, I can walk into an elevator, and I'm the only black man there, and I can feel people clutching their purses and their, and just that uncomfortableness. And I know it's not a projection that I'm putting on. I know that that's out there. So I face that every day, just about every day. I face some kind of discrimination. With that, I'll ask you.
I'm Steve from Southern California. Up by LA, now down here. It's interesting, this started several memories going back, and it seemed to keep getting earlier and earlier. And I'm part Filipino, and when I was a kid, kids in my neighborhood, they knew that, and so that was a way to separate me from them. But I'm only part Filipino, and when I got together with the family, my mom's family, the Filipino family, there were kids my age as well, and they were more Filipino than I. I was part white, so I was kind of discriminated as well. So I kind of got discrimination from within my family and from outside. That was difficult to deal with. Okay.
I'm Brian. I'm originally from Portland, Oregon. I think I've pretty lucky I've not been discriminated, but feared that I would if I said I was gay or HIV or even in a three-way relationship. But I've come over some of my own discrimination. I thought people that were in a three-way relationship was a bit yuck. I've also overcome trans men for IML and different events. It was in a discussion group in here, and within 20 minutes of meeting a dozen trans men and how they identified to be a man, that I was able to say, they have every right. That person is a man. He identifies as a man. I believe, he's a man, and that's what, So I've overcome some discrimination that I thought, pre-thought, and then after you experience and know, then I'm better educated, I hope not to set boundaries and to not have those prejudices, so I don't do it. But I do have the fear of, myself, but I think I've been lucky that I haven't felt it. Well, I felt it because I thought if I said what I was, I would be discriminated. So I have that fear. I want people to know me first before they know, you know, gay, HIV, and whatever. And now, you know, I'm also a fetish kinky guy and have a lot of other things too. So I'm like, well, so I evolve in time. And so I do give people that do discriminate a little bit of leeway because they just haven't quite got there because I was one of them, you know, for that kind of thing. So,
My name is Donnie. I'm Native City again. The first time I was discriminated against, I would say, was in my own family. My older brother would always tease me when I played Barbie dolls with my neighbor girlfriends. I didn't have a lot of boys my age in the neighborhood where I grew up, so most of my friends were girls. And, well, I was played with the girl toys. So I gave him and his friends to come over with a skateboard. And say, oh, it's my second brother playing with his girlfriends, and da-da-da-da-da-da. I'd say the worst time I was discriminated against was probably when I was 19 and I was with a group of my friends on the trolley and we were going to Tijuana because that's what you did before you were 21. And it was also safer to go back to Tijuana then. And we were talking and laughing and a couple of guys from the other side of the trolley heard us making comments and basically tried to pick a big giant fight with us on the trolley and caused a big scene.
My name is Richard, and originally from Philadelphia, raised in that area. And I've been in San Diego ever since 1965 when I came to boot camp here. So I consider San Diego my home. And the first time I was discriminated against was in my early teens in high school. I was a quiet, introverted kind of guy. I knew I was gay, and so I was trying to keep my head low and kind of stay out of everybody's radar, but they picked up on it anyway. And there were quite a few times when I would get roughed up. I mean, I never came home with a black eye, but I came home with clothes torn from being knocked off the bus and trying to fight back the tears. And in a way, I think I kind of discriminated against myself there because I never let anyone in my family know what was happening.
I'm John, and I'm from La Habra. And the two of them actually popped into my head from very early age, and they both have to do with my family's income when we first moved to California. When I was going to school, I was the only kid in the group of my friends who had a mom that worked. Everyone else's mom was the stay-at-home mom that, you know, made all the treats for the kids when they came home from school, and I was the kid who walked home by myself and used my key and went inside my house and called my mom to let her know I was home. So there was that, and because she had to work, we didn't have a choice, or else they were going to lose their home. The second part of that was I had kids asking me if I was poor. Now, I grew up in Laguna Niguel, California, not a poor city. We lived in a three-bedroom house that was in a nice neighborhood, not a poor neighborhood by what people would consider. But all of my clothes came from places like Gemco and Target and didn't say Maui and Sons and Billabong and Quiksilver. And so the kids would ask me, "Are you poor?" And I said, "Why?" "Well, your clothes don't have any labels on them." And so I would actually have kids whose the kids and the mothers would discriminate against me because they're like, "Oh, look, poor Jonathan. His mom's not home. We should be nice to him." And, you know, but they all talk behind my mother's back about it. And then the kids would all treat me differently because my clothes didn't match what they had, that my clothes were. They actually figured out that it was the same clothes that I had worn to school the previous year. And so they would treat me differently and make fun of me as a result of that. And it's I look back now and, you know, it's the silliest thing I've ever thought of, but that was a big deal to me when I was 7. So, you know, I had to have my mom go and find clothes at like a used clothing store and things like that so I could have a couple things that said some name brand on it so that I wouldn't be embarrassed.
Speak up.
I'm Pop Nikita. I'm from Alabama, living in Charleston with my dad. And this entire time as y'all have been talking, I've been trying to come up with something, but the thing really is just after I was about 6 or 7 years old, I basically became numb to all that type of stuff. Yeah, I've been called every name in the book, picked on all the time, but after it happened so much to you, you just kind of stop caring. So, I don't know. Growing up in school and all that, I didn't really have many friends because, I don't know, you just, after you become numb to it, you start getting angry at everybody else. Because everybody else, I don't know. No, I don't really know.
I'm Daddy Ron. I live in Otay Ranch. I've been in San Diego since 1978 when I came in the Navy, and I never left and went back to Texas. First time I discriminated against, I guess, was when I was in junior high school. The typical fag, sissy, queer, whatever. And I always thought it was because I was in the band. You know, I didn't take PE, I was in the marching band. No, I knew why it was, but I guess that's the first time I was discriminated against was, like I said, I was in junior high and I played a violin at the time. So that's what it was about.
I'm Master Timothy.
Yay!
Yay!
I grew up, and it's embarrassing, I grew up in Kansas, where in 2014 they're still debating teaching creationism in science classrooms. So it's embarrassing. First time I'm thinking about this, I'm trying to think when's the first time I ever felt discrimination. It's the first time I ever realized that I was different from other people, and it came from within my own family. But we used to live just around the block from my grade school, and we would walk home from school. And there was a shortcut between the houses where there was like a space between people's property lines, and you'd sneak through it. And there were these teenage kids that lived right around the corner from that. There was one of their houses, and you're sneaking by it. And they would run after the little kids that were using the shortcut, and if they caught you, they'd beat the snot out of you. So we were doing the shortcut one day, and I was about six. I think I was in first grade. And they caught me. So I get home, you know, my eye is swollen shut, and I've got blood pouring out of my nose, and both of my lips were cut, and I think they knocked out a tooth, one of my baby teeth. Mm. And my mother was washing all of the blood off of me, and my mother looks me straight in the eye, and she says, "You know, the bigger boys wouldn't pick on you if you wouldn't act like such a sissy."
Oh.
Thanks, Bob.
And yeah, I didn't realize I was different from anybody else in the whole world until that moment, and it kind of one of those defining moments in life. I've never forgotten that moment.
And
that would be the first
answer. So try to collect that memory. It doesn't have to be the first discrimination. It could be something that's significant, not necessarily the first thing you remember.
Thank you.
My name is Jay. I was born here in San Diego in 1948. I've never been discriminated against. I came out my senior year in high school. Drag queens brought me out, so I hung out with drag queens and lesbians. Everybody in school knew I was gay, but no one would dare say anything. Mm-hmm. I was on football and wrestling, so no one said anything. And in college, same thing. I hung out with lesbians in college, and guys would come to my room at night, want me to fuck them. But, yeah, I couldn't suck them or kiss, but I just fucked them. And same thing happened.
Are you fucking them?
No, I did fuck them. And the Army, the same thing. Although once three guys said something about suck their dicks, I looked at them and said, "Oh, suck small dicks," and I just turned around and walked away. So I've never been discriminated against. Probably because I had big shoulders, or I used to when I was younger. I had big shoulders. So.
Mm-hmm.
What's that?
The unicorn. In a way. Mm-hmm. You were guided through with a good set of community people.
Yeah.
You said that you hung out with a lot of lesbians.
And drag queens, yeah.
Good place to be growing up. All right.
Yeah, Stuart from upstate New York. Probably the first time, and I want to point that out, noticing discrimination was and I'm sure a lot of guys probably relate to this, being the small guy picked last for the team.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that's when you realize you're different, you're less than other people. But then in college, I lived in a dormitory first year, and early on, you know, got a group of friends, we hung out, we had lunch together, and so on and so on, until we found out I was gay. And as soon as they found out I was gay, I found myself at the table, the discussion going this way and that way, and I'm like totally feeling the blocking out. And I ended up just going and sitting by myself and resented it, was hurt by it. And then I'd see the people in my group in the hall by themselves, and they would talk to me, and they would be apologetic and so on and so on. It's like, but they couldn't talk to me when anybody else was around because they were afraid. And I realized, you know, that's what it's all about, fear. And, you know, fear of association, fear of, you know, that it's going to stick on them, that they'll be associated with something so negative, even though they didn't necessarily view it that way. So that was an interesting experience and very hurtful, but, you know, I tried to understand what the dynamic was.
My name is Bob. I live in Chula Vista. I don't know that it counts as discrimination exactly, but something that happened not too long ago that just kind of left me feeling like, I don't know, was I was on vacation with my other half, and we had met up with a couple of other couples, gay couples, and we're hanging out with them. It was a cruise, so, you know, in the evening, you basically see the same people a lot. We were hanging out with them, and just, you know, we seemed to be having a very good time, and we were having a good time. One evening after we'd spent the evening in one of the bars and just maybe having a few too many cocktails and maybe getting a little loud or what, I don't know, but we were standing at the elevator, all going to be heading back to our rooms, and these two women walk by, and one of them nudges the other and very loudly says, "Oh, there are the gays." And it was just the tone, you know, was so, you know, my initial reaction was, "What the fuck do you care?" But at the same time, the way she said it, the tone, that was such, I don't know, derision and you know, unclean, that kind of thing. It just kind of ruined the whole evening for me. And, you know, it's like, not discrimination exactly, but it comes from the same place. Let's put it that way. It certainly came from the same place. So
you're saying they sound very condescending?
Yeah, very, very like, what are the, why are, you know, who let them in? You know, that kind of thing. What are they doing here? You know.
Qualifies.
I'm embarrassed to say this. I have a lot of shame attached to this. It's difficult for me. I never have broadcast gay on any channel, so that was never a problem. But the entire time I was in grade school, up until seventh grade, I had no friends for one reason. I'm smarter than anybody else I know. And I got picked on a lot because of it, because I don't fit into any of the boxes, in that my skills were that I could always come up with a better way to do things. I have never done a book report in my entire life because I was contemptuous of the whole idea, because I was reading more books voluntarily than all the rest of the kids in my class. And I got picked on, and I got D's and C minuses and F's all through grade school because I was so tormented, because people were telling me I was retarded. People were telling me, you know, just I got beaten a lot. The way they could tell was that every year we would do the aptitude tests, and I've never scored less than 99th percentile on anything in my entire life. And the teachers would make a big fuss about it, and that made me a target for everybody. They wanted really badly to show me that I wasn't so good after all. And my first friends that weren't my sisters in all of school, I met in seventh grade, and they saved my life, basically. And I got a lot of beatings from my dad for being too uppity, being too smart for myself. And, you know, there's a lot of pain attached to that, too. But the kids could tell that I was not going to fight back, and so then I got beaten constantly. I was the smallest kid in my class because of my birthday is at the end of the year, December 6th, so I was always the smallest and youngest. And then, thankfully, first day of seventh grade, I showed up 6'3", and the beatings stopped. And shortly after that, I took a pitchfork to my father to make him stop beating me, and that stopped.
Words of Arium.
Pardon me?
Words of Arium.
Sure. No, that took a while longer, but you know, if I'd have been stronger, it would have happened. But bottom line is, I'm embarrassed to say this because this is not the usual story, but it's my story, it's my history. And I've learned to love who I am as I am, because I didn't get any agreement. Going back, trust me, Catholic school in the 1960s, the last thing they needed was somebody with 187 IQ. And I was the pink monkey in the cage full of brown monkeys, like you wouldn't believe. And it really did scar me for a long time. So, how about you?
I'm Keith. I'm originally from L.A. And fortunately for me, it took me, because I had other things in my life to deal with, it took me till about 37 before I had my first, quote, homosexual experience. So, and by then I didn't care. So I didn't really notice if somebody were being condescending or not, because I think I'd gained the maturity enough to say, hey, you know, you live your life, I'll live mine. That's it. So that's it.
Now, before Travis speaks, I want to vouch for his good character. Travis is my mentee. I have taken him on. I am his mentor. He is a fine man. I vouch for his good nature. He is heterosexual. And he is here specifically at my invitation, and I ask that you all welcome him as well, because he would like very much to share whatever is so for you. Okay?
I do.
Whatever is so.
Travis, I was born and raised here in San Diego. In keeping with the topic, grew up very poor. Both my parents were drunks and dope fiends, so we had no phone. Water, electricity was getting shut off constantly, hand-me-down clothes and stuff. So that was the first thing that separated me. And I had just a very handful of friends, and I didn't react very favorably to that environment. And by the time I was 16, when my parents divorced, they both left and left me at the house, and I was homeless from the time I was 16 to 18. Called all the family, and they all said, you can't come here. So being discriminated directly from my family was the most impactful thing that has happened to me as far as discrimination. Thanks.
My name is Harold. I now live in my boyhood home. Name of it is Hillcrest. It's in the province of Alberta in Western Canada. I didn't have much discrimination during my life either, but I'd like to tell you about two incidents briefly. One was rejection by a family member when I finally did come out, and I came out late also, mid-20s probably. And we were walking together on the campus of a college I'd gone to in Alberta, and he turned to me and said, well, you know, I've got real problems with you being a gay, he didn't say a gay man either, being a gay. And it instantly felt like my heart was dropped to the ground, because I'd had a lot of trouble coming out to my family. I'd had a couple of supporting statements. My mother was still puzzled. She never said anything negative, but she was puzzled by it. she thought she'd made some kind of mistake and asked a couple of my lady friends about it at one point. That broke my heart too. I was just very sensitive to rejection. I have no siblings either. So it was a cousin who said that to me, that he had a lot of trouble with me being a gay, and I didn't know at all how to respond. It came out of the blue. But I tried to be witty and tried to be almost angry in response. Well, can you imagine the trouble I've had with it? But that went nowhere. We tried to sit down and talk about it, but I couldn't remember a word of the talk. It just felt like the worst feeling in my life, because my family's always meant a lot to me. So I just want to fast forward quickly to a time when I was sitting with my then boyfriend in Mr. A's, that nice restaurant at the top of the building at 5th and Laurel. Nice soft lighting, we're holding hands at the table, a glass of wine, and it was wonderful. Just talking quietly, being in love, and a Hispanic waiter came over to us to just fuss at the table with something, and he said, "We don't allow that kind of thing here." And we were both startled and kind of looked at him. My boyfriend just kind of cringed, and I said, "I'd like to speak to the manager, please." And so he was shocked at that. I think he expected us to pull our hands apart and, you know, cringe and maybe leave. But we just waited for him to leave to go get the manager. My friend wanted to leave, and I said, "We're not leaving. If anything, the stage will be set for this man to leave. But Locke loses his job." I had a very different reaction than when my cousin fronted me on. The manager came over, was extremely apologetic. I asked him if he would immediately talk to that employee, not wait till we had left. And he had some little trouble agreeing, but he said, "Well, yes, sir, okay, I will." And apparently he did, and it was fine. We had a lovely evening. We got a lot of special attention for the rest of the time. So you learn somehow, and I think I learned a very important lesson about self-identification.
When you said someone said a gay, my dad said, "Are you one of the gays?" in his broken English. So it was
another
recall.
The gay.
The gays.
Mr. Gay to you.
Hi, I'm Jeff, and I'm born and raised in San Diego, but I'm recently back again. And my heart's beating, sorry. Well, they all are. We will be sitting there, right? I don't know if this counts as discrimination, but I guess I'll just put it out there because I'm really shy and lots of other things right now. But I was actually, I got so many walls up these days, but I was the target for a predator, I guess you would say. And so the number one thing is I just have a lot of trust issues. And anyways, I was going on a dinner date. And I talked to the guy for a couple times and everything, but anyways, so we were going to go out to dinner, and he offered me a beer while I was finishing getting dressed or whatever, and when I came to, I won't tell you all the details of it, but I was strapped, could not move, whatever, and ball gagged, and it was probably at least 3 hours of him and a few other people, but anyways, their basic intent was terrorizing me and humiliating me, and sticking whatever they could inside me, and they took something from me, and I'm going through a lot to get it back. It was maybe 7-8 months ago, and so I got all clean and sober to make sure that it wasn't that I was that circumstance, and you know, things happen in life, and so my gig is to going strong. I lost my mom, and that's why I was out there, and so I'm back in San Diego, and I'm making new friends and starting my life again, And I just wanted to share that with you guys. And there's a lot of people sitting there. I feel embarrassed. Sorry. Anyways, I'm Jeff. And
thank you.
The gay part wasn't bad. So growing up, I mean, not okay. Anyways, that's that. Done.
You're around welcoming and safe. Thank you,
Jeff. It's trust that I'm not going to regain again. So
excellent. Speak up, please.
Jeff is my friend, and I am one of the first people who ever talked about that, and you guys just don't know how powerful this moment is. Because fear, and fear of being gay, has dictated many of our lives. And I finally got to a point that no one was ever going to hurt me more than I could hurt myself. And within that, not only knowing the distinction between black and white, but my father was military, and I grew up, and certain kids weren't allowed to play with me, so I've known all along, and the only way that I could transcend all of it was with love and forgiveness. And that has carried me and saved my life through my life. The most violent things I've ever experienced have been at the hands of whites, and even more violent than that was at the hands of black men. And I've experienced extreme trauma in my life. So there are little subtleties of discrimination where people will talk to you or hang out with you. You can experience that every day. When I walk down the street, I can feel the fear of people. And don't let it be at night, because I look just right the fuck Trayvon Martin glasses and all like this at night walking down the street. And I've seen grown men cross the street and women clutch their purses or walk on the other side of the car. Well, you know what I do now? When I see them coming, I walk on the other side of the car to make them feel more comfortable so that they don't have to be afraid of me. The thing about it is that I've experienced and seen things that no child of God on this planet should ever experience. And I've survived it, and I've transcended it. Part of the thing about being a hypersensitive is when you can feel what other people feel. Hate is a dark, black void that it takes an awful lot of power to change. And I've dedicated my life, my spirit, to just being available for love. That's something that I can teach, something I can share, and it's something that I've learned that has saved my life. I was a victim of a violent hate crime here in San Diego, four black men, and they took everything from me. And as a result, I spent the last 20, 25 years hiding in my room, drinking and using whatever I could not to feel it. The funny thing is, there's this first half of my life from the time I was born to the time I was mid-20s, and there's this second half of my life with my life partner. Every single one of my friends and partners that I've had in my life, they're all friends with each other, and they all know each other, and they all get on well. Those of you that have experienced me, I don't let carry so much, and yet that's the whole purpose for being. I don't want to talk about the negative discrimination. do want to talk about how to transcend that. And this is what I think that we do here. My fears are real. And the magnificence of Papa Tony is that my biggest fear. He helped me transcend in one figure eight motion of 15 minutes of me allowing myself to be flogged with compassion and with love. That for me was everything. Discrimination happens every day. It's irrelevant as far as I'm concerned. What is important is that this is a safe place for me to come, for all of us to come, to figure out how to treat each other so we're not discriminated against in this room and in each other's presence. And with that, I'm going to pass, because I'm not doing tears.
Thank you both for sharing. I'm Rod. I'm from North County, and like Master Timothy, I came from Kansas. And as a teenager in high school, I was fucking horny as hell. I still am, but that's a different story. But I went to the bus station, because people with drug guys would drive around, and that was a way that I would meet gay men to experience gay sex, because I knew that I was gay. Didn't want to admit it, but that's where I went, and I went there quite often on the weekends. And one night I got arrested by the vice squad and taken to the police station and taken into a room, and two cops called me faggot, queer pussy, and I was mortified, shaking, and I got put in a cell. My dad got called and had to come pick me up. And when I got home, my dad was extremely upset because no son of his was going to be queer, gay, and whatever. But the wonderful end to that story was that my dad became such an accepting, tolerant, gay-friendly man as he researched and heard things on TV and whatever, and realized it was not a choice that I made. It was who I was from birth, genetically and whatever. And so, but that discrimination by two men trying to make a teenage boy, you know, just shaking his boots and so forth, and they were getting their sadistic pleasure, it was extremely traumatic.
Matter of fact, it is time to take a short break.
Oh, is it now?
Yeah, it is break time now. So, shall we do 10 minutes, gentlemen?
All righty. So, back to our discussion. We're going to start off again. Your name, where you're from, and quickly, discrimination you felt outside of the gay community. And try to be quick so we get the rest of the whole thing.
Okay, I'll be fast. I'm JP. I'm from Lansing, Michigan, which is 90 miles from Detroit. And I brought that up. It's important because actually at age 12, I moved to Okemos, Michigan, which is like the more affluent area. So I can relate to the couple of people talking about the economic thing, because that was a big impact when I was 12 years old. And not only that, I was like, oh, you know, I come home every day and jack off to the boys. I'm not thinking about girls at all. And yet, I come with a very middle class, lower, kind of lower middle class area into an affluent area. And those people, it's real, the kind of discrimination thing. You just don't fit in. And that's what this discrimination is, a place where you don't feel like you fit in, you're not part of the group, you're separate. And it really impacted me at that age. The other thing I want to bring up is a little closer, is one other thing, is with HIV. And then I became HIV positive in about 10 years ago. And all of a sudden, you know, you're going online and people are like, oh, you know, I want somebody who's clean, not diseased. All this kind of stuff, and I was like, well, I really had to go through a whole new coming out thing with HIV, like, you know, all this shame, and I don't fit in with gay people anymore, and, so there's been a lot of other little things through life, but I think I'm glad, because otherwise, you know, I would have been a white WASP guy with all privileges, and it wouldn't have been as compassionate to people who had to go through shit, but I've had plenty of opportunities to experience discrimination. So,
past.
Byron accidentally was born in Jamaica but raised in Ohio, so so that's how that is. I guess my discrimination was basically was in the military because I was an air traffic controller, so it was different for being African-American to be an air traffic controller back in the early 90s. So basically that gave me a different perspective, a certain type of racial in that regards. I was pretty much quiet in my genre of air traffic controller, so I got picked on because I was quiet and got called names being gay, and it's like I didn't do anything gay or nothing, so I got for that. So therefore, only reason I got out of that is basically I put myself out there to them and made it more interesting for them, so if they're going to call me gay, so I'm going to act gay to them, and basically that's how I got out of it, because they just leave me alone after that. But my whole thing was because being an air traffic controller, and I was about the only black guy there, so that's how I got mostly big picked on for that. So it was in between being gay and being African American, so I kind of have both of them at that time.
So. Thank you. My name's Jeff. I grew up in New Jersey and lived my adult life in Georgia. Moved here in 2007. And to be truthful, I can think of no situation in my entire lifetime that I felt prejudiced. That I can recall. Did happen, but you know, it's not like I was fluently out. I mean, I never talked about my sex life. I had sexual partners. I don't know how I remember now, it's so long ago because I graduated from college in 1970, so it was a little while ago. And I was out in my high school years, and there was actually nobody in my high school that I was still labeled that I think back and say, well, they were definitely gay, you know. But I somehow accepted my own gayness right from the beginning, and I never felt any prejudice any time in my career or life.
My name is Michael. I pretty much knew it wasn't okay to be gay right out of the gate, because my dad said I'm not going to have a son that's queer or pansy or, you know, the whole. And I had three very aggressive brothers, and it was like always, I was always out. Even now, the family's like, you know,
speak up.
Here I am, and there's everybody else. And it's always been that way, you know. It's like my brothers to this day, I mean, call me coal smoker. they have a whole litany of things that they say to me, and that, it's ongoing. So I choose to live in San Diego. They live in Bakersfield, which is, as far as I'm concerned, a perfect town for that kind of stuff. So I knew it wasn't okay to be gay even before I knew what gay was. I just knew I was different. You know, most of us girl people, you know, there's something different about you, but you're not sure what it was. But the first time I slept with a guy, I said, "Aha, that's what it is." And I just been trying to go forward ever since.
I'm Michael, and I was born in Kansas. I was raised in Kansas also. I was very nervous as this was coming around the room. And I guess there's two things. First of all, I think one issue is for being deaf. And I did not realize it until I was older. And I've never been self-conscious. I was the first kid on my block to have a hearing aid, as you might imagine. I was 6 years old, so I was never self-conscious about it. But I think other people were. And it's just never been. And the real thing, the real discrimination I had when I was growing up was I was in Catholic school.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this group of kids, and it wasn't after school, it wasn't walking between two buildings or anything like that. It was right in the hallway, in front of the teachers. And they looked on and they did nothing. And I was so ashamed of that for so long. And this is the first time I've ever talked about it without writing it down. So,
Tom from Chicago. Two quick ones. About 15 years ago, I was interviewing investment bankers to do a Series C round of funding for my company. And I found the one I wanted. I was interviewing him, and I thought, this is the guy that I want to do this job. And in the informal part of the end of the interview, he joked and he made kind of an off-color joke, something the effect of something bad had happened to me. And he said, "Well, at least you're not gay."
No.
That cost us $1.5 million in commissions. dumb comment, wrong guy to make it to. About 2 years later, I had to fly to Armenia, which is a former Soviet republic. Wall was down, so they were not Soviet anymore. And I had to fly there to do a morning TV show for a charity that I worked for. So I did basically Good Morning America and left the show. Was walking down the street talking with our executive director who worked for me. And everything had gone really well. The feeling was really good. And she said, "You know, I just kind of wondered by knowing you." She said, "Are you gay?" And I kind of paused and I thought, you know what? I did not check the State Department website before I came here. Which, for those of you who travel internationally, you know you check the State Department website before you go anywhere. So I hadn't checked it, and I said, "Yes." And she said, "Wow, we used to execute gays 10 years ago." So that doesn't make you feel really good when you realize you skimmed by that one by 10 years. Anyway, those are my stories.
Good evening. My name is Scott, originally from San Diego. Early on, I was separated from the rest of the class by being smart and also by being fat. So when you're consistently picked last for team events, for several times, not a big deal, but when it's every time, mm-hmm. And it's always you and the same five people, that gets there's a message here. And also because I did well in classes, scored well, that did not win me any favor either. So those are two examples from my past.
All right, I'm Brett. I grew up in Huntington Beach. And, you know, I can just think of a lot of little things that, you know, also bullied in school, particularly middle school. I think that was the worst. Those were the worst years. When your body is just awkward and everything's awkward about what's going on with you. So that insecurity, lack of confidence, you know, being called fag and queer and gay and all those things. Other things like, you know, later in life, little things like checking into a hotel with my partner and, you know, you want one bed and you get kind of a funny look at the desk. I had other examples. There's a lot of little examples that I was recalling whenever I'm sharing. And I'll let you know if I think I'll move on.
I'm Brian from Cincinnati, Ohio. A period that comes back to me when I was in Catholic high school. Day of AOL Instant Messenger, there is someone that I was talking to, chatting on Instant Messenger, and he had said that he was gay and that, you know, he lived near me and wanted to meet me, and I was very excited because I had never met another person who was gay before, and he asked for me to send him my picture, and I did. And at that point, then he told me that he was making it all up, and now he had my picture and all of the chat of everything I said, and he was going to post it on the wall at school, and he was going to tell the teachers and the principal, and I was going to get kicked out of school. I was kind of mortified, and I didn't know what to do. And so I decided that I was going to get out ahead of it. It actually ended up turning out fairly well. I was in a class. It was faith and the sacraments or something like that. And they had a prompt to share a secret that was, or some shame that we had that we wanted to let go of. And so I shared what had happened online, and I didn't know what to expect, whether people were going to you know, turn away from me or freak out, and the group of peers in the room were all like, you know, you're really brave for having done that and having shared that with us. The teacher was like, I didn't know you were going to do that. I wish you would have told me. I was unprepared. I responded so well. And the principal contacted me not long after and said, you know, I hear that part of this you were worried that you were going to get kicked out for this, and, you know, don't feel like that is a problem at all. We stand behind you and we support you. So then I went from a period where I was really afraid of what was going to happen to feeling very supported. And I know that that probably wouldn't have been the response if this had happened 10 years before. So I feel really lucky for that.
Okay.
But, my name is Frank, and I'm originally from Long Island, New York. And I mean, so many similar things that people are saying things. But for me, I went to nursing school right out of high school. I didn't know I didn't come out right away. And so when I went to nursing school, that's where I noticed some of the prejudice because, you know, nurses, especially male nurses, like gay. And so, I mean, I wasn't out at the time, so I didn't really associate so much with that, but I felt that way. And so, I mean, I felt that prejudice. So, and it was kind of subtle because, I mean, the kids I was in school with, I didn't feel that with them, but people that I worked with, other respiratory or whoever I was working with, they would maybe not, it was subtle, so they maybe wouldn't talk to me, they wouldn't say anything to me, but they would avoid me or, you know, that kind of stuff. So it was kind of, the prejudice, the discrimination that was there was kind of very discreet. So it took me a very long time to finally come out. I didn't come out really until I was in my 30s, but because I was going through this whole process of between honing my nursing skills and trying to be the best nurse, and being the best nurse meant not being a gay nurse. So that, it, you know, I struggled for a long time with that until I came out of third.
Thank you. All right, so we just talked about discriminations that we all experienced, well, not all of us, but most of us experienced outside of the gay community. Now, there's discriminations that we experience within the gay community, in particular with the kink community.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I know in the past there's been a great discrimination against the Leathermen and kink niche back probably in the 70s and 60s. I watched a YouTube video. If any of you are familiar with Mr. Leatherman, Chuck Renslow,
mm-hmm.
Does that ring anyone's
bell?
He is the IML.
Yes. On YouTube, he has a video where he talks about discrimination against the Leatherman community. He discusses about back in the 70s. I'm not sure if it's particularly true about San Diego, but he describes that in other places, they would always put the Leathermen and the kink community people in the back of the parade.
Mm-hmm.
And they would, along with the drag queens, because back then, I guess, the drag queens weren't as the forefront as it is now. You see it now, everyone's advertising for drag queen shows and whatnot. And so, I was wondering if anyone knows in firsthand about any of that discrimination.
No, I was there. My first Pride Parade was in 1976. I haven't missed one since. Things have really changed a lot since those days, as far as the kink community, because we were constantly being told that we should not be in the Pride Parade. We were disgusting. We were not representative of the community. That, for instance, the reason why the Leather Realm is separate and hidden and all that, it's becoming less hidden. But it was because, for instance, they didn't want us to have any flyers whatsoever, because what if somebody picked one up and it was a child, and we must think of the children. Well, of course, everybody must think of the fucking children, right? Well, the thing is that, I mean, I've lost a lot of friendships where I would mention to the gay leathermen, they'll say, that disgusts me. I don't ever want to talk to you again. I get that. And I'm sure that rang a few bells there. But back in the old days, you have to understand, I'm a hard ass. I mean, when I first came out as a gay man, I was what I called a pie-in-the-face homosexual because I'm 6'5", and I outweigh the fuck out of most people, and I'm not going to hide anything, and I never have. I came out in 75 with a bang, and then I just kept on coming out. And my intention behind coming out with a bang, even though I could have easily passed for straight with no trouble, is that I wanted the world to fucking change. Well, I've been that way with the whole kink thing, too, ever since the beginning. I've never hidden it. Back when I was in the Navy, from 76 through 79, I was not only openly gay, I was openly leather. I would go on and off the ship in full gear. And the petty officer of the watch would say, "Where are you heading, Lindsay?" "Never mind, I don't want to know." But, you know, I've been very determined. But, you know, it has not been easy. That a lot of the other gay guys on the ship would entirely avoid me because I was radioactive, because I was bold and they simply were not. You know, but it is what it is. But, see, there have been times, and this is not so now, but there was a time when I wanted to go up to the gay center and it says lesbian, gay, whatever, and I wanted to spray paint, but not leather, center. Because we've been chased out of there so many times over the decades. It has not been our center. That's why we're here and not at the center. Though now the real reason why we're not at the center is they charge us. That's the only reason, because they really want us back. And they've made that plain. But again, the same thing is that as soon as something bad would happen, bam, you're out of here forever. I mean, we got banished a lot. You know, some guys are sucking dick in the bathroom during the Mr. San Diego Leather Contest. That's it. You're never having it here again. And see, now, I just found out yesterday morning that I had been gently, just not even seriously negotiating with them about the possibility of using the Grand Auditorium, and found out that they had actually waived the cost. They wanted us so badly there. So that's something to have for the future, but I did not know that. That what I want to say is that the world has changed. Now, okay, I'm sorry for editorializing, but I got to say this. Now, as a man, at least in this part of the world, if I show up wearing this, people are not afraid of me. As soon as they see that I'm friendly, they come roaring up to me and say, "Oh, please, can I have a picture with you? Oh, please." If I go to a trendy place for dinner and I'm wearing gear and there's people with purple mohawks and neck tattoos and the big earlobe plugs and they're trendy and they're hip, they're whatever, but if I walk in gear, I fucking win. Everybody says, "I want to be him when I grow up." Because immense amounts of street cred. I mean, I'm saying within my lifetime that I've seen this. At the Mr. San Diego Eagle Contest, when it was done and everybody was going from the contest location over the Eagle, I sat at the corner of 30th and University and I watched. It was a very crowded night. Lots and lots of hip young heterosexuals bopping from one bar to another, little boutique to coffee shop, crowded streets. And in the midst of this, there is these gay leathermen, clearly gay leathermen, and some of them with assless chaps. And they're walking down the street and people are going, "Oh," like this. They're going, "I picked the right night." You know? And so what I'm saying is that within my lifetime, it has radically changed. And see, there's somebody I was speaking to this weekend who lives out in Georgia. And he is certain, he's a librarian in a Catholic university. And he was certain that there's just no way that he could support young guys because it would jeopardize his job and he wouldn't, you know, all this stuff. And I said, "You know, have you checked lately? Have you really checked what's really going on around you?" I said, I think it's Mississippi that like 78% of people think that gay marriage should be okay. Or that, not that's the wrong statistic, that no one should be fired for being gay. It's like Mississippi. The things have been changing so radically that my request of everybody who is thinking that there's still just as much discrimination as way back then, check in now, because things have really been changing.
But it is surprising that I thought we'd advance, and then Arizona tried to pass that.
Yes.
And there was a couple out of it, but that's right at the forefront. And I thought we'd moved beyond that kind of discrimination. It didn't pass, but by just one governor not signing it, a crazy governor not signing it, it didn't happen. And I thought we were way beyond that. In Russia, that was the other one, Russia, I thought they were beyond that. You know, I thought everybody was more accepting of because Europe has gay people in the Navy and stuff way before we did. So I kind of thought Russia was there too, but they weren't.
Two things real quick on that. When you're talking about different things and discrimination dropping away and how that level is changing, as kinky people, this year, the 13-14 school year at Harvard was the first year that they have now a kinky club on Harvard. On campus at Harvard, it has a faculty advisor. They have meetings. They have meetings. They have officers. They have fundraisers. It's a big new group on Harvard University.
And is it just kinky in general, or is it the gay community, or is it?
It's pansexual kinky. Anybody that's kinky can be in this group. And then what was the other thing you
Russia.
Said? Russia. And you want to talk Russia? Historically, the bad thing about Russia is it's left over from Tsarist Russia is the problem that they still have with the gays there. There was a lot of homosexuality in the upper classes in Russia, and it was considered a class thing. And the upper classes were incredibly cruel, and there was a lot of sadistic sort of stuff going on. And that's why there's still such a societal hate-gay thing that they can still prey on. They've come a long way, but it still leads back to their Russian Tsarist past.
Unfortunately, Kansas, as great as it is, has Reverend Phelps, who was the man who took the leather pry pictures and then put them into all the ads across the country to scare straight people about gays. And we never saw normal gays, but we saw the leather gay people to really scare people that, oh my God, these are such perverts and kinky people and everything else.
And
so
that's interesting because in the video that I watched with Mr. Leatherman, Chuck, he said that that's one reason why they put Leatherman with drag queens in the back of the parade. So that they said that also that they hoped that the press would leave by the time the end of the parade came.
Yeah, we were always the most entertainment.
I always thought they were saving the best for last. I really did.
I went to college at Columbia in New York, and it had the first gay student union of any college in the country. And that was back in the 1960s. Now, I wasn't there back then, but I was there when they celebrated their anniversary. And when I went to Columbia, there was simply no big deal about being gay. I knew things were changing when I was reading the New York Times once back in the 1980s and 90s, and it said that there were 1,000 organizations throughout the country in high schools supporting lesbian and gay youth. And I thought to myself, my God, things have really changed since we were all in school.
That's good. And I noticed that you guys, almost all of you, are from different states and not around here. I wonder how separate, before you left, did you see the kink community from the gay community? Like, how was there some sort of divide? I wonder.
My first experience with the kink community was absolutely by surprise. And I have to tell you, it shifted my perception of what was possible. Because it wasn't vanilla, and when I was required to inflict pain and use hot wax and I guess you'd call them pros, at first it freaked me out, you know, but I didn't know I was using the pro to prepare him for my fist, and it was a novelty to me, and so that happened. And my life happened, and that memory was always there, like, oh my God, you know. So I have to say that, you know, man, tricky shit happens to you when you're a kid, okay? And it happened to me when I was a kid. I was 17, 18, right place, right fucking time, totally by accident. But on the other hand of that, there was a curiosity factor, and that's what got me killed. Being curious at the wrong time, wrong place, the wrong people, which I never thought I would get past it, but I did. And I'm getting past it in this moment just by letting it let me go.
I want to make an observation. I'm 56, and I've been out since I was 21. And the typical thing as a kid, you know, I knew I was more attracted to guys, but I didn't know I was gay. You know, I didn't know what that was. Like I said, this is my opinion. I think maybe a lot of people agree with it. I think if you're gay, and we'll just pick on gay males, even though we refer to them as vanilla, we all know what kink is, we all know what fetish is, and I'm here to tell you that even the gay guys that we think are vanilla, they've got some kink to them, they've got some fetishes to them.
Oh, yeah.
They just prefer to be gay and not be leather, not be, because we all know you don't have to be leather to be kinky and fetish. Leather is a fetish. And I think we look at the gay part first. That's what, and I'll go back to the last 30 years because I've seen it from 21 to now. In the last 30 years, things have changed like night and day, and I think Papa Tony will agree with that. Just because of the bars. We had undercover, you couldn't go to the bar and hold hands. You had undercover cops coming in, so on and so forth. But I think the gay came along. That was the thing, was the gay coming out, and the kink and fetishes were all there, but they were closeted. So we came out of the closet as being gay, but we kept the kink and the fetish in the closet. And it's only here, I don't want to say recently, but it's only been in the last few years that we can be gay and we can bring our kink and our fetish out of the closet too, so we can actually shut the door, and, you know, on the closet, and not
yeah,
worry about it.
You know, you notice discrimination or prejudice in the gay community when they make derogatory comments about this fetish or that fetish. It's disgusting. Oh my God, I can't believe people do it. Blah blah. You know, it's like those kind of things that set a tone where, okay, I'm not going to say anything. I don't want to, you know, you get, they're putting us in the closet by saying those kind of things rather than just being accepting, oh, that's interesting. I think we've all experienced that probably to some extent, listening to our gay brothers out there say those things.
I just want to, one thing when we're talking about discrimination and coming out as kinky and that, and I hate to do this to you, Travis, I want to put you on the spot for a second, because this kind of fascinates me about you, but how does it feel coming out as a hetero man who likes to hit girls? Because Jesus God, from the moment you're this fucking tall, you don't hit girls.
Yeah.
So that's got to be something to kind of overcome, because, you know, there's a lot of girls that like it, obviously, mm-hmm. and... But as a guy, you've got to overcome that in order to get in touch with that side of you that enjoys that domination and that power.
So what is the exact question?
So how does that feel when you have to explain that to people as a hetero guy? Because as a hetero guy, I think, as a gay guy, they, you know, they already think we're creepy, and it doesn't really surprise me. Not only do we want to fuck each other, we want to beat each other up while we're doing it. But, you know, you're supposed to be a straight guy, and you're supposed to be all soft and tender and romantic,
oh,
and carry a bed covered in rose petals and ravager like a dream book. How does it mean to tell people that that's not the image of where we're at? I mean,
okay, for me, you know, it's always acceptable to spank a little bit, you know, and to start with that and to say, you know what, I like to do a little more than that. And I don't feel the need. I mean, if they ask specifically, I say, are you sure you want to know? I mean, really think about this. Do you really want to know?
Yeah.
You know, like my mother-in-law has talked to us, and my wife just goes, do you really want to know? And she thinks for a minute, and she goes, no. And then off she goes. I don't have a problem with it if they ask. You know, I don't get as much shit about it. Now,
it's just kinky.
Yeah, I mean, I've been kinky my whole fucking life. I mean, I was stealing my dad's porn from the time I was 6. So it was, it's been a part of me, and everyone knows I was the first one of my friends to get laid. I was, you know, all that shit. And so I haven't had a problem with it. I own who I am. Mm-hmm. it's I can only imagine it's easier being straight than at least, you know, as far as society goes. But as far as hitting her, it makes it a lot better when she enjoys it. I mean, the reaction I get, I mean,
right.
If it was, I mean, I might as well just hit the fucking couch. If it was, if it's just about hitting something,
right,
it's about the connection. So that's how I got past it. It's, I've had that want, that need. I've always been a sadistic little fucker. You know, in school, in all the games that I always used to play, even with my friends and stuff, it was always something I always had to win. I was always ultra competitive, and so it was this manly macho. I felt powerful and stuff, and so that translates over. Power plus love equals this. You know, I get to transmit this thing, and that's how I got past it. Is that it's not a bad thing. I destigmatized it for myself, and so it's not an issue.
Okay. Cool. Actually, I have a question for you. I know that there's a stigma with being a kinky weatherman in the gay community. And how's that stigma within the straight community? Like, how are you perceived? Like, in terms of someone were to know, like, is it?
Now you're talking just like vanilla or kink? Like within the kink world, because there's, for me anyway, there's a small fraction of leather people within kink, and there's a little bit of differentiation there, but then going even outside of that umbrella to the vanilla world, is that what you're asking?
Yes,
about in the vanilla world?
Kink, and then like outside vanilla world, how do they perceive?
Maybe what you're asking is like the guys that you work with
they're jealous.
Okay.
They're fucking jealous.
What you're trying to find out is what do the straight guys think of him being kinky?
Yeah.
Oh, they're jealous. I brag about this shit. Like this is because I mean, really, it's me, and they wish they were me. You know, like you were saying about the people seeing all the leather guys coming out of the Eagle that night, and they're oh fuck, that's awesome. Or you walk it into the bar with the people with the mohawks and the neck tattoos going, fuck, I want to be like that. That's how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they greet me
yeah.
when they hear that I was with, you know, four chicks on the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, fuck, really? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I spanked every fucking one of them, and I did this, and I did that. And they're like, Jesus, I wish I had your life. And you're married? Yeah, my wife was there too. She's bi.
Yeah.
Thanks to the phenomenal success of 50 Shades of Grey, I think we're going to have discrimination very much more. Than
yeah.
The straight community is so into women by millions and millions and millions are getting their husbands to read those books and read these passages, and women are so turned on to 50 Shades of Grey series. It's like phenomenal.
Yeah, it's the world record owner for like the biggest. It's like the world record best selling novel ever. Yeah.
Back to your question about how fetish and the leather community is perceived in the gay community in other states. I lived in Washington State in the Seattle area for about 10 years, and the community back then it was. A lot of you'd hear, and this was even among bears, who are generally kind of like a marginalized group of people, or were for a long time because they're not skinny and fit and fit this set of things that attractive gay men are supposed to be. Even among men, they would, you know, I would hear things like, "Oh, well, you know, those guys, you know, they get into that stuff and they can't have a regular orgasm anymore. The only way they can come is if someone beats on them." Or half an hour. Or, you know, and this is from a group of people that was already marginalized and looked down upon by the community at the time. You know, that's changed, they're celebrated, they, you know, they jiggle their furry bellies on the parade floats and everything, and everyone cheers. But, you know, and now, having friends up there, you know, and it's 15 years later since I first moved there. You know, they have a fetish night at the bar that's kind of like the local bear bar. and the community up there has really come around to become more acceptable. It was basically like if you were involved in fetish back then, you scurried your way into the Eagle or you went into one of the sex clubs, and that was the only places that you, or at the Cuff, and that was kind of silly. I mean, they had a sling up on the wall, but the likelihood of any actual Leatherman actually walking in there on most nights was really a joke. So it was more of like a novelty. But they've really come a long way where it's just kind of like, oh yeah, there's the leather guys, or oh, they're doing a fetish night, everybody needs to get their hankies. And mm-hmm. It's amazing how much that's changed. But during that period, up until like 2006, I saw a lot of just, and just over the silliest things, like water sports, it's like you meet a bear, like there's a 70% chance he's into water sports for whatever reason. But, even that was like, oh no, that's too, we don't talk about that. I do that, but we don't ever discuss that in common, in common company, because I don't want all my friends to know that I let some guy pee in my mouth. So, just stupid things, but it's come a long way. But that's the way it was for a long time. Like, you just didn't talk about those things. At least not unless you were certain that it was a safe person.
A big part of fear is turning it into fun.
Yeah.
How do you turn fear into fun? And for me, that was the key to show that it can be fun. And that's something that I learned and was positively reinforced through this group. So I don't fear the process in the group. Where my fear would come in is, Tony had made it abundantly clear, you don't go out on a recon or do these things because there are people that are predators that are looking for inexperienced people to literally take advantage of. And that was a big eye-opener for me, to be patient, to wait until I meet people that I can trust. Mm-hmm. I can have an encounter where I can trust. Because trust is everything when it comes to fun in this regard to me.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for making that point.
Mm-hmm.
But to stir the conversation even deeper, I've been saying things outside again and outside. Now within, between other kink community members, what have you noticed discrimination? Like, between another Leatherman, what would you hear?
Well, this is going to be hard for other people to relate to, but this is my truth. I've been a leader in the leather community for decades, and I have found that there are plenty of people, not plenty, but a good number of people who would be perfectly happy if I died in a fire. Because I'm too much. I'm too much this, I'm too much that. I'm too big, I'm too bossy, I'm too male, I'm too domineering, I'm too effective in what I do. And as soon as someone new rises in the community, there's a certain number of people that will gather around that person and say, you really shouldn't trust him. You really should stay away from him. He's a bad influence. And they don't have anything specific that I've done, but they don't like the fact that I'm a charismatic, big male. I can't tell you. I mean, I've been through 9 tribunals, really, with the problem of how to deal with the Tony Lindsay problem of people trying to stop me. Not because, and so then one time when I showed up for what I thought was a business meeting, and 40-something people sitting there glaring at me, and I, what's this about? Because I knew what it was about. They said, well, you really screwed the pooch. You're going to have to stop doing what you're doing. You're a loose cannon. You're a bad person. I said, okay, I'm going to say, let's save some time. What is the single worst thing that I have ever done? Everybody stops. I said, I'm not asking for 3, I'm not asking for 2, just 1. What is the worst thing I've done? Finally, this little tiny leather lesbian steps up and she says, well, you're awfully big and scary. I said, there's therapy for that nowadays. Oh, how rude. I said, listen, the very definition of bigotry is to be prejudiced against someone for something they have no control over. I said, I can't help being big and scary to you. If you have dad issues, get therapy. I'm not your dad. In the meantime, let's get some work done. The offer remains open. I'll see you guys at the next business meeting. And I just left. But see, nobody has come up with something that I've actually done that is bad. But there are still, to this day, in 2014, people who are actively gathering around new people in the community and saying, stay away from him.
He's the wrong person. Stay with us. We're the good people. Those are the bad people. There are people that are very aggressively steering people away from this group, just so that you know. Not because of anything that we've done, but we represent danger. We are the wild men. We cannot be tamed. We are not being domesticated. We don't have lesbians in charge of us. You know, I mean, that sounds terrible to say that, but in the decades past, that was beyond toxic. It isn't so much now, but it was for a long time. And that within the gay male Leatherman's community, we had a lot of women who really wanted to tame us because we were a problem. So I'm just saying, you know, I don't know how it is fully now, but I know for a fact that there are people that are being actively told not to go anywhere near us. And we're as virtuous as can be. Yes?
And you think more so that it comes from now that we're too touchy-feely.
Ah, yes.
How dare we be so loving and hands-on,
yes,
and sweet to each other, and you know, that's not how a real Leatherman's supposed to be.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, most Leathermen, they open up their mouth and a high heel falls out.
No.
I wasn't expecting on that, because I've always been kind of on the edge of the leather community. I mean, I've worked at Wills for a while, but, you know, and I've been doing a lot of people in the leather, and I was always accepting of it. I didn't really notice any kind of, like, it's, for me, it's just another way of being, so it was cool. But within, but some of those people sort of have, well, you know, you're not, you know, you're not doing it. You're not wearing the right clothes. You're not, you know, you're not doing the whatever S&M thing that they're into. So I wasn't, I felt kind of excluded in that sense. Of like, you know, I'm like, and I think there is kind of almost a cliquishness that can exist in some of the people that I think Papa Tony's talking about are kind of very exclusive, and they don't want to open it up to other people.
Some of them thrive on secrecy.
It's not, I don't think it's so much secrecy, it's cliquish.
Mm-hmm.
San Diego leather community is so full of at least, what, eight cliques, would you say?
The thing I find fascinating is you guys hold yourselves accountable to each other and respectful to each other. And in some of those cliques, you'll never know what the fuck they do to people behind closed doors. Period.
All mean girls.
Wait,
leather heathers.
Before I continue, you brought up a point and how we perceive people or people perceive us. A few weeks ago, we had a meeting about ageism, and Magnum led that, and he mentioned something called the rejections, in which when we project what we think someone is doing or what that person is, it can be often projected upon us too. If you're out in the community and you clearly look like you're part of the leather community or kink community, and people will project what they think you are and who you are. And one of the common things is you're a big scary man, and that's why they won't approach you. But our projections towards others, and then people outside the community too, hinder us from really, like, not discriminating, if you guys understand where I'm going at. Like, we also project on other people,
mm-hmm,
within our community and outside.
Yeah.
I'm bringing this up just because with what I talked about before, with not having the right clothes, mm-hmm, that can be an issue in this community as well. Like, oh, you just wear boots from Payless. Those are not Danner boots that you spent $250 on.
250?
You know,
yeah.
These are the cheap ones. you know, you're not in head to toe leather. You know, you just have, you know, you only have, like, I only have suspenders and a few pieces of leather and a jacket, things like that. But, you know, you actually hear comments of, like, from people like, well, what's he doing? He's not even in leather on a leather. It's like, you know, really, I'm sorry that I don't own enough leather. You know, I don't have this job that pays so much money that I can just deck myself out head to toe in gear. You know, and especially for a big guy, it's a little more expensive to cover yourself in cow. So, you know,
that's not why you then have leather. You
well,
earned it, yeah.
Once upon a time when I was a free agent, that was the
case. No, but I fully relate with you. I'm a college student. I'm paying other things that,
right,
I wish I was not paying for.
Right.
I have to slowly save money for, oh, that looks like it's on sale, or that rights me, and so I buy my own leather, but it's very slow. And then sometimes you're just like, And it doesn't help when, you know, you have that those comments coming at you going like, oh, you don't have enough leather, or you look kind
of... Or even they'll say formal leather attire for you to go to an event. And I'm like, yes, because I have a collared leather shirt and, you know, all this stuff just available to me. And I'm already paying for this dinner, but sure, let me spend thousands of dollars to outfit myself and stuff so I can walk into a banquet dinner and have rubber chicken.
I want to add to that too, and I know we don't talk about the old guard that much, but I'm sorry, I still have allegiance and I still have a lot of beliefs in the old guard, but I also have beliefs in, and I don't call it a new guard, but the new way of life. Anybody can buy leather, and I hate that. You can go online and buy leather. I go, and probably here in San Diego too, but I go to LA and I see, and no offense to Masters, but I see guys in L.A. in head-to-toe leather, I mean complete leather, including the cap. And they're no more a master than he is. And to continue. So my point that I want to make is the leather does not yet. There you go. The leather does not make the leatherman. Correct, Papa Tony? It's how you feel. It's what you believe. It's what's in here. You know, everybody, I keep pointing to this here all the time and everything I do. It's what's in here. So you can go out and spend $3,000 on leather from head to toe that is not, in my opinion, going to make you a leatherman. Sorry. Leatherman is something you learn. It's something you mentored into, it's something you're guided into. So if anyone ever tries to give you the saying, well, you know, you're not a leatherman, all you have is a harness, you're more leatherman probably than they are. So
I have
last little thing real quick, and then I'm going to shut up for the night. The gear invasions that we do, that's our chance, because we were talking about the community out there. When we do the gear invasions, that's why it's very important that all of us show up and do, you know, wear your harness, wear a leather belt. That's all you have to do. Wear your boots, blue jeans, and a t-shirt.
Or rubber running up green.
Or whatever it is. But the gear invasion is what we show the people out there, you know, what we're all about, and show that we're good guys. We're not molesting little children. Okay? Thanks.
I have to interject for just a second. First, this... Could you hand me this? I'm not sure why I brought it, but I brought it. This is my oldest piece of gear right here. This was made for me by Sterling of West Hollywood, who invented assless chaps for gay leathermen. And he was my first mentor, and he made this for me. And he told me, one of the many things that he told me that I pass on, is that leather is just a frame for the picture within. It doesn't define the picture, it's just a frame. And what I want to say in counterpoint to what you say, nothing wrong with anything that you said, but I want to be really clear. I can't afford to give you guys all leather or whips or whatever. I'm doing the best I can, and that's not the point. The point that I'm making is I don't know anybody else who's in the kind of biz I'm in, which is mentoring. We don't have enough to go around, so we have to kind of lighten up on the, well, if it's bought leather, it's not real leather. I want to kind of counterpoint that. We have to accept that at least for the next 10 years, we have to let go of that. So that people can catch up. Because if we wait for a very finite number of mentors to sign off on people, we can wait a long fucking time, and most of us here will be dead before that happens. So like I said, let's take at least 10 years off from old guard for a little while and kind of let everybody catch up.
Except buying these caps. If you're not a master, don't buy this
cap. All right.
I'm heartfelt about that.
All right.
Many of you may have heard this, but every bar in the world is an S&M bar. Stand and model.
Yes.
And so when you're modeling your new leather, $3,000 worth of leather, but you don't have a leather heart mentality, fuck it. I mean, you know, you're not a master. You're just showing what you bought, what you purchased. And full tuxedos. I've seen pictures of Papa Tony in tuxedos where that, you know, looks sexy as hell, and I bet you he probably could be one fucking hot master in a tuxedo without any piece of leather whatsoever.
Right.
Yeah, right. Hope he doesn't make the
two things. If you're looking for gear, there's the Fetish Finds on Friday.
Yes.
So Eli,
yes.
Well, I'm not running it, but I'll do it. So Eli
it's good.
Does it once in a while. It's donated items, and he sells them, and then all that money is going to, I think, the Leather Foundation.
Probably.
Anyway,
he and Aaron
going to charity.
And every time I find something good to buy.
Yeah.
So this is at Numbers, starting at 10 o'clock this Friday during the harness party. And you don't have to wear harness to get in. You know, just take your shirt off and boogie, baby. It's a fun event. But, yeah, Fetish Finds, yeah, that is a really good place to find gear.
Yeah, and I was thinking, you know, we still do need to do a lot of education with the larger gay community, though. Even though the acceptance is going up, there's still a lot of just ignorance and misinformation out there. You know, we're just out, and, you know, some random person will just want to grab on. And
yeah.
Like, you know, no, we don't know you. You're a stranger. You don't just, people, you know, so just a lot of ignorant things that happen out in public still. I think that's why the Leather Realm is so valuable, because there's so many people that go through there, and I think that's a good opportunity. And, like,
sure.
Your invasions also, these times are valuable, because that's part of, I think, educating people about, within the gay community, about what this is about. And I think a lot really don't know. Even though there's a movement toward that acceptance, there's still a lot of education that needs to be done around what the Leather community is about.
I'm watching Papa Tony. He has an amazing ability to go around and talk to people and disarm them. And it's something that we all could take a, you know, page out of the book.
I'll be glad to teach you guys how to do it. It's really easy.
All right, we only have a few minutes left. We'll have concluding thoughts.
Along the lines of what we were discussing about within the community this morning, I'm a member of San Diego Possibilities, and I popped in after not seeing him for several months, pretty much dressed as I am right now, and got a lot of awareness of my being there. And several of the members there are aware of Leather Fetish, and some of them actually have mutual friends within this group. And one of them came up to me, and he said, "Well, how are you doing there, big boy Richard?" He's obviously seen my name on Facebook. And then he was cautioning me about having these things on Facebook. And I thought to myself, but this is where I choose to come out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is my gear invasion.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yet he and a number of other people were all kind of going, ooh, ooh.
Dealing with their own issues.
Their own issues, yeah.
Yeah, a point I wanted to make earlier is that I think that we're all heterosexual, bisexual, gay. We're all the product of a very puritanical background. This came from a field of education where I heard people who were psychologists, counselors, teachers wouldn't refer to body parts that involved the you know, they would talk about an arm, but they still use words like pee-pee and things like that and in discussion among other professionals. So, I was in a discussion with like 500 educators. So, as long as we continue to have that mentality that's passed on to young people, we're going to continue to have, whether you're gay, straight, whatever, we're going to have that kind of thinking. So hopefully we can get to a place where people aren't so afraid to talk about it. Talk about something that should be something we're afraid to talk about.
Probably about maybe about 15 years ago, I used to have to commute between L.A. and San Luis Obispo. The way I did it was I kept a motorcycle in San Luis Obispo, and I would ride my motorcycle to LAX, and parking for motorcycles is free at LAX. So that was my way of commuting. I'd get on the plane every Monday morning, and I'd fly up there, and I'd fly back on Thursday night. So the way I did it, though, is I'd lock my helmet to the motorcycle and walk into LAX with really very S&M-like motorcycle gear on. It was tight, because I liked it, and that's the way I did it. So I would commute on the airplane, no helmet, with all my leather gear, and I was doing this kind of regularly, and one of the regular flight attendants finally asked me, she said, "Why do you fly like this all the time?" And I told her, I said, "Well, if this plane's going to crash, I'm going to survive longer than you are. So she did. She thought it was funny, but the other passengers didn't anyway. What I learned, though, is I started to do my long-haul flights that way. So I started to fly. I started to just park my helmet on the back of the bike at LAX, which is the way I commuted, and I commute to JFK. I commute to O'Hare. I commuted a lot. I was probably on, I don't want to say hundreds, but maybe that many, at least that many round trips, dressed in full leather gear, the only guy on the plane doing it. And there was a part of me that was like you, which is just screw all of you because this is the way it is, and it's good for you. At least I could educate 200 people at a time if it was a 747-350. So I did a lot of commuting, many, many flights that way. And the funny thing is I never had a negative thing happen, not yeah. once. Nobody ever messed with me. And so I think sometimes we're our own worst enemy.
Yeah.
I think sometimes the self-consciousness we feel is coming more from us than anything that's ever happened to us. Bad things have happened to us. But we almost think that bad thing is going to morph into this bad thing. Another bad thing is going to happen if I dress like this. And all I can tell you is I've been out in public as the only guy dressed like that in very visible ways, standing waiting for cabs at JFK. No one ever refused to pick me up. Showing up at the hotel that way, never. And they didn't do it as part of a letter that's coming. I mentioned this was business meetings. So all I can tell you is I'm a small sample set, but a sample set of at least about 100 round trips, so probably 200 flights with cabs or walking through airports. Never a bad experience. So you got that going for you. Your odds are pretty good.
That makes me want to mention something. So you said that ourselves could be the worst enemy when it comes to doing whatever you want. Sometimes one comment that you may hear that you don't like, we could really discourage you. And for a long time, it comes to the point where it's really yourself that's keeping you from doing it. But also, it's a trigger from that one comment, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what I want to conclude, did you want to say?
Just a certain point out about education, that we need to get the word out when you find out that, 92% of pedophiles are heterosexual, that yet so many people think it's the gays or the pedophiles. We need to educate ourselves and people about things like that. So the truth is out, not the hearsay of what people want to believe about us.
And I have one final thought I'd like to share. The obstacles in our paths are not obstacles. They are the path.
Mm-hmm.
And one more thing, like I was saying, how one thing could discourage someone else. And so when it comes to new people who come into the community, like, for say, that they come into the Eagle, and you're there, and you see them, and sometimes if they look like they're out of place, they're probably really curious, and they just want to see if they could mingle with everyone. But if we keep isolating those types of people, then we really keep them from coming in and exploring what we know and what we like. Because for all we know, they could really love it. That little twink boy that you think, oh no, he's never going to like want to be a part of us, might be really kinky in the inside. And so keeping our discriminations between each other, and like sometimes when someone who's from the outside overhears your gossip of you talking shit or crap about the other leather man, then they'll be like, well, he has more leather than me, and I have barely any, then what am I then?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so if we keep the mindset that we're more of a brotherhood than isolated little paths, then we can make progress together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good thought.
Mm-hmm.
Very well said.
And I think that's about time.
Okay, so then can I make a few points?
Yes.
All right. First of all, I think that Ariel did extremely well tonight, didn't he?
Yeah.
Also, I want to also make a very important point. And by the way, you did very well. I'd like to talk to you at great length about this later on. But I also want to acknowledge Michael. You'll notice, I mean, I'm assuming you did all that. But did Michael do all the table back there?
Mm-hmm. Well, me, Michael.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's not take it for granted. He's doing this out of the goodness of his heart every damn time.
Thank you
so much. And as far as upcoming events, we've already talked about Harness, and I will definitely be there. I will definitely be bringing the toy bag. We tend to really, really set the tone, meaning us folks. What happens at the Harness party is, yes, there are people there who are, you know, who are on the bar's email list, and they found out about it, and they're strutting around in gear and all that. Well, we really kind of show everybody else how to have a really good time, because we get the party started. We're so nice. We're so good to each other. And people have come up to me so many times saying, is it right that I really prefer hanging around with this bunch of guys? I say, it's fine with me, because they feel safe. They feel glad. They feel welcome. They feel like they're right where they need to be. So it's a really good event. Incidentally, I designed it. I don't know if people knew that. I don't run it. I don't have anything to do with it. But when they were thinking of doing something like this, I gave them a list of things that would make it a success, and it still is. You know, and I'm not taking credit beyond that, that I knew that we needed something like this in our community, an excuse to just go out and just get hot and sexy, you know. So anyway, so having said that, Harness Party, then what else have we got? I haven't been paying close attention this week. I've been kind of not in the space after doing the Mankind Project. Quick plug. How many men here, show of hands, have done the Mankind Project? Yeehaw. Okay. I'm going to do a big fat plug, but I'm going to be very vague. Before I did it, I didn't know the first fucking thing about it. They do have a website. Yeah. And it's important that it not be a big deal knowing beforehand. You have to go through the process. What I found out is that when I created Fetishman San Diego, I was actually creating a kindergarten version of the Mankind Project. And I'm okay with that. I was fumbling around in the dark, and I now have found out, thanks to this weekend, that there's an advanced course for Fetishman San Diego that exists in the world. I strongly, strongly endorse it. I have reached amazing changes in my life. I haven't been talking to the group about it much, but you've noticed a few things. Like suddenly I'm saying, we're doing the big change over this next week. Because it's time to hand away. Now I need to explain it. I'll talk about this more next week. But the reason why it's so important that the group, that I completely relinquish the car keys. Grandpa's not driving anymore. The reason why is because I trust these men. These are beautiful, wonderful men with big hearts, with absolute powerful character and good natures. And this is not my first time creating an affinity group. I've actually created quite a few. The ones that have survived and thrived decades later are the ones that start with a solid team. And that's what we have here. You guys trust each other. We went through some lumpy shit a few months back. You guys showed up as being men of character. You've been supportive. You've been absolutely sticking to it. That when it got uncomfortable, you stayed with us. That says everything about your character and your nature. That's why I can so gladly just say, oh, thank goodness. My brothers can have, you know, what I created with my blessing and my utter trust. And that's what next week is going to be about. We're going to be talking about the history. We're going to be talking about the future. We're going to be talking about what people have as ideas going forward, because there's some things that have not been working well. I'm not really fond of doing the email newsletter, even though it goes out to thousands of people. We'll be talking about this next week. Let's find some other way so it's not so much work. But anyway, so enough about that. So then there's a lot of really good stuff coming up on the week. In 2 weeks, we have the wonderful play party, and this one we're going to be having Officer Wes, who's going to be talking about electrical playing. I'm going to be bringing my box full of gear, too, so we can all have lots and lots of zippy-zappy fun. Yes?
Oh, I just wanted to mention at some point about his birthday
party. Oh, yes, please. Let's get that going, please.
So this Saturday in
this Saturday. Ranch.
Yeah, right. Yeah. This Saturday, right? From 7 to 9 at Dad Ron's house is a pre-party. We're going to have some hors d'oeuvres and some punch and things like soft drinks and things like that for those who don't want to be out late or maybe don't want to be out at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're meeting at 11:45 at the San Diego Eagle, 11:45 p.m.
Out front.
And we're going to walk him in because he turns 21 at midnight.
Oh.
So we'll walk him in at midnight and buy him a drink.
That's right.
And he will happily accept drinks from anyone who would be willing
to. If he gets sick, it throws up in my car.
We're bringing
back. What if we make our own drinks for him?
Oh.
Well, there's a yellow hanger back here, so.
So just as one additional thought, in the last weekend in May, the weekend after IML, then as many of you know, then we're going to be having the big movie night and a bunch of other events surrounding it and all that. My intention for this one is to teach everybody how to do what it is that I'm doing so that it doesn't go away if I get hit by a truck or something. I want this to become crowdsourced, this whole thing that's coming up. We'll be talking about that. I want everybody to have a stake in the success of this week, the last week in May, because it's going to be so much fun. And it's going to be easy. You've got me behind you. I know how to do this shit in my sleep. And I want to teach other people how to do the same sort of thing, where it always works. I mean, really, how many failures have we had? And I can't claim it because it's been all of us together pulling together. And everybody gets to share in the success. So this is crowdsourcing, as we call it. So we'll be talking more about that. But I thank you guys for being who you are. My heart is light.